Okay, the recorder's on. This is World Affairs Month, and I have on the line today Mr. Jose Bustani. He's a pretty famous, in fact, I should say really famous, Brazilian diplomat, born in 1945, so he's 78 years old. From 1967 until 2015, he was in the Brazilian Foreign Service, of course. He was the first Director General of the OPCW in The Hague, and the OPCW, for people who, most people probably don't know what it is, it's the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, and that's again in The Hague in the Netherlands. That was from 1997 to 2002, and what happened basically is Mr. Bustani looked like he was getting in trouble with the U.S. government, and they effectively removed him as head of OPCW in 2002, and you know, that was pretty traumatic. I interviewed Mr. Bustani in the summer of 2002. I think it was the summer. I don't have access to my old World Affairs Monthly. I will soon, but anyway. He and I did this great interview, and I'll republish it at some point when I find it and I can get my hands on it. But you know, the fact is that you know, Mr. Bustani was a high-level diplomat working in The Hague and doing his job, and I was doing my job, and we connected and did a great interview, and now we have a chance to talk again. It's great to talk to you, Jose. By the way, he was ambassador to the UK from 2003 to 2008, and he was ambassador to France from 2008 to 2015, and of course, in 2015, he retired. By the way, he's an accomplished pianist, and he has performed concerts around the world for the past 25 years or so. Anyway, it's great to talk to you again, Jose, and you know, yeah. you're a good friend. You're a good friend, even though we haven't talked in a long time. And you know, I just want to start out by saying that you and I were engaged in what I would call this high level bureaucratic battle, policy battle. And you know, we basically both lost. You know, and you were sacked by you know, Brazilian government really didn't support you probably, and the U.S. government wasn't really thrilled about what I was doing. But we were both doing the right thing. We were both doing the right thing, and we were doing our job, you know. And today, I have prevailed. I'm now quite influential, and I'm sure, you know, you are too. So I wanted to see if you could explain to me, you know, you said in an email when we were preparing for the interview that, you know, a lot has happened. You were joking around, of course. So a lot has happened. What would you say, Jose, to everybody about this world we have now? And imagine if you and I had succeeded back then. You know, imagine that. It would be a different world today and probably much better world. But, you know, war is very tempting. And, you know, these folks in Washington were very much in favor of pushing the interests of Israel at the expense of the Arabs and Persians. And so anyway, great to talk to you. I hope things are going good.
Yeah, great to talk to you too, Tom. Before I come on the present situation, I think I have to go back to the year 1997 when I was first elected to UPCW and to that period where I was dealing with the organization. I have to explain to those who are listening to this recording that I was always involved in my career as a diplomat with multilateral things, etc., and disarmament, non-proliferation issues. And what really fascinated me then was for the first time, the Convention for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons was a non-discriminatory one. So every single member belonging to this convention had to accept to be submitted to inspection, unlike the Convention for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons in Vienna. The five nuclear powers are excluded, as you know, from that convention. And I always had a problem with that idea of excluding the five nuclear powers from any action on the part of the organization in charge of implementing the convention. But AOPCW, on the contrary, was supposed to be applied on equal terms to every single member. And that fascinated me. It was a challenge because, as you know, normally the political and economic power of the United States within the multilateral system always prevails. So what I'm saying is that normally Americans have a say that it's indisputable in every single international organization. And when I became the director general, I said, well, this is going to be a test and a challenge. It is my desire to possible to be in charge of an international organization and make it function according to the convention and to be exempt from pressure, etc., etc. Well, I was the idealistic person. I still am. Then what I did was just try and implement the convention according to what was there and attract as many members as possible, because that was my mission, according to the convention, to enlarge the membership. When I was elected, it was the convention had 87 members, which was the minimum for the convention to enter into force and for the organization to launch its work. When I left, it was about 150. So I'm very proud that I managed to almost double the members of the convention in that period. Of course, I launched different areas of action of the organization, first of all, to destroy, monitor the destruction of chemical weapons in the U.S., in the Soviet Union, Russia then, other countries that had chemical weapons, India, Iran, and South Korea, for example. So we launched that successfully. It started the process successfully. And then the second action that I had to do is to monitor chemical industries everywhere in the world to make sure that no deviation from the purposes of the chemical industry would be used to build new chemical weapons. And the third one, which was one that I created normally, was to help very minor countries, developing countries, to be able to have a chemical industry for their own survival. But on a basis that would be impossible for them ever build any chemical weapon facility. So we had to help them to have the dyeing of fabrics, this type of stuff. So you had to help them and attract them to become members of the convention and give the necessary membership, the international, the number of members that would really value the convention. Well, I was working very hard on that. My main problem that was the Middle East, of course, because most of the Arab countries refused to join in because they knew that Israel had chemical and nuclear weapons. And they wanted to at least have the right to eventually develop a chemical weapon facility to counter the power of Israel.
Sure.
So they refused to. But I never gave up. I had contacts, direct contacts with most of them, etc., etc. After, by the end of my fourth year as Director General, and then I have to explain that, I had a mandate of 4 years. By the end of my third term, most of the member states, in particular Russia and the U.S., asked me if I accepted to be re-elected 1 year before the end of my term for another term.
Wow, yeah.
Because they were very happy with what I was doing.
You're doing a great job.
Of course. That was during the Clinton administration. Okay? All right. So I was re-elected 1 year before the end of my first term.
Right.
And I went on doing my job. By that time, I was already in touch with most of the Arab countries, in particular Iraq and Libya. Because they were very, the main actors within that context. If I managed to get them into the fold, I was sure that other Arab countries would follow suit, and then it would be a huge success. Elections took place in the U.S. and the Bush administration was different from what I had experienced in the past. Nevertheless, as soon as the Bush administration took over, I got a letter from Colin Powell, first year of the administration, praising my work and saying that he would be very happy to go on working with me, etc. So I was really happy with that. I said, okay, so I'm doing my job. Some of the most important countries are, saying that, so let me go on doing my job. But I'll change by the end of that first year. Of course, I was doing my job. I tried to seduce those countries like Iraq and Libya and others to come in and join us. And the cause of something that happened, the cause context of the United Nations. You remember that when the United Nations had a special force that would have to go to Iraq to try and recuperate some of the samples that were left behind, Saddam Hussein at the time did not allow UN inspectors to go to Iraq. Mm-hmm. But then the head of the Commission of the United Nations asked me if I could send my inspectors. And I said, okay, of course, they are available. And Iraq, Saddam Hussein, then accepted the OPCW inspectors. Mm-hmm. And that gave me a good indication that our inspectors were respected, because the organization had been working very, very seriously, without discrimination, without any ideological bias during their job. So I said, well, this is what I have to do. I have to really to explore this avenue in my relationship with these countries. And this is what happened. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, our inspectors went to Iraq. They did the job for the United Nations.
Right.
And everything went smoothly. Mm-hmm. And then again, by November 2001, I got the reaction of the Iraqi and the Libyan government, both of them, saying that they were ready to join in and accede to the convention. Mm-hmm. Because at that moment they had not signed, so it was not a question of ratification, but a question of accession to the convention. Okay, well, I was delighted with the news, and it meant that 30 days after getting their letter, I would have to send a group of inspectors to launch the first inspection, both in Iraq and Libya. Well, when I got these news, I called the representatives of major countries, the most active countries in the OPCW, and I told them, listen, very good news, we will have a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. We'll have Iraq and Libya joining in, and most probably the other heavy countries will fall suit.
Yeah.
And when I told this to the American ambassador, he was furious. He said, you're not authorized to do this. I said, how come you're not authorized? This is part of my mandate. This is the language of the convention. I don't understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And he went on, he was furious. And I thought that something was very wrong. So then time went by, and they sent Mr. Bolton to The Hague. And I was absolutely flabbergasted when he came to my office, and he didn't say good morning or anything. You see, I came here with a message from the Bush administration, in particular Vice President of the United States, to say to you that we are not happy with what you're doing, and we give you 24 hours to resign from the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Bolton, I'm shocked. Why should I resign? I was elected by acclamation twice, including by your country, and I don't understand what is the reason for my resigning. The reason is that we are not happy with what you're doing. So what am I doing? Well, you know what you're doing, and it doesn't please us. Mm-hmm. No, I'm not resigning. I have no reason to do so. And then he said, we already talked to your government, and they agree with us.
Yeah.
At that moment, I must say that I was shocked.
Yeah.
Then I confirmed that it was true. Yeah. I was betrayed by my government.
This is Mr. Cardoza?
Yes. I said, you must be wrong, Mr. Bolton. The Brazilian government is a serious government. He would not do such a thing. But I had to do that, of course.
Yeah.
And then he left. He just left without saying any word.
Yeah.
And then they started a campaign, which was completely crazy. And the only forum for them to try and oust me was the council of the OPCW.
Okay.
The administrative council of the OPCW, which was the regular meeting body of the organization. Well, then they convened the meeting of the council to discuss this question. And the council voted for me, so I was not ousted by the council.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were desperate because they needed me to leave the OPCW. And they then started a campaign against the convention, calling for a conference for that purpose. Mm-hmm. And that was not foreseen by the convention. There couldn't be any conference for that purpose, for the purpose of ousting a director general.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, with the pressure, the political pressure itself, they managed to get, the votes for that conference to be convened, general conference. And they managed to do that. It happened in April 2002.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had found out that my government had really betrayed me and never asked for support, etc. And in the end, what happened was that South America, Africa, and Asia abstained.
I see, yes.
And I was voted out by the Western group.
Right, right.
Except for France. France abstained.
France stood up and supported you. Huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm married to a French woman. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, of course. And then Vidrine was the foreign minister.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Vidrine, yeah.
In France. And, and President, then the candidate for the presidency, Lula, was in Paris in that period. And mm-hmm. he met Vidrine and he asked him, what is going on in The Hague? I'm shocked. I don't know the Brazilian guy who was there, but... Why are they doing this against the Brazilian guy? And Vidrine was very supportive and said, don't worry, we are not going to support the U.S. and others to ask Mr. Bustani because we are very happy with this one.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened. That's why France did not vote against me.
Right.
But then again, in the process, Lula happened to be elected and then became president. And this is another chapter of my life. But going back to that moment, and so I was really cornered by the Americans during that conference. I had no argument.
Yeah.
That I could not prove that I hadn't done anything that I didn't even know
it
was in.
Well, Jose, can I interrupt you a second? Isn't it clear to you and I that the new administration determined that they were going to go to war in the Middle East, and that was all there was to
exactly.
it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And they couldn't possibly allow you to deal with the Libyan regime and the Iraqi regime in the way you did. You were being fair, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. But it took me some time to understand that because we all concentrated on the question of the Twin Towers. And there made no sense to talk about Iraq or Libya in relation to what happened to the Twin Towers. So it took me some time to study.
Yeah.
Realizing that it would be
exactly. Yes, it took you a little while.
Yeah, a little while.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, it takes a little while to figure it out.
Yes, because it was so crazy. That
it's so crazy, yeah.
But then I realized that. Yeah, that was what happened.
Yeah.
And then I had to leave the organization. I left the organization, and they put someone who might replace me, an Argentinian. Then,
mm-hmm.
at that moment, Argentina and the United States were very close, very
mm-hmm.
close.
Mm-hmm.
The then president used to say that they had calmer relations with the Americans. That was the expression
That's funny.
Created by the guy who replaced me.
They really
destroyed the organization. I must say.
Yes.
From that moment on, everything that I had built
was wiped out. Yeah. Wiped out.
Starting with the loyalty of the group of 211 inspectors. They were paid by the organization with money from the member states, that they had to be loyal to the organization, not to their countries of origin.
Mm-hmm.
All that culture that I had cultivated, making sure that would happen, I was always present for the debriefing of inspectors as they returned from their inspections, and make sure that every single process foreseen by the convention was followed correctly. Everything was destroyed.
Yeah.
The sort of setback, the inspectors, they started working with inspectors designated by member countries and paid by member countries, and, you know. So loyalty was not to the organization anymore, was to the country of origin. And that's what is happening now to the OPCW. And that's what happens at recently, in the very the last 6 or 7 years, and that brought me back to the question of the OPCW at present, and then we can discuss this later.
Well, now, isn't 9/11 sort of like the turning point for you and I? Because, you know, before 9/11, you know, before 9/11 and before, well, actually, the turning point probably was the bombing of the two embassies in, I think, 1998. I was in Africa at the time. And perhaps you remember the bombing of the American embassy in Dar es Salaam and the bombing of the American embassy in Nairobi. And I didn't know it at the time. I mean, I was there. I was there at the time. I was actually passing north, and I had just been with my wife to the Dar es Salaam, and then we went to, and, you know, and then we were looking. I had a BBC. I was listening to BBC World Service on my shortwave radio. Anyway, so we were there, and I was kind of shocked, but you know, I was busy with things, and I said, I didn't really recognize that that was a turning point, right? And then, of course, 9/11 hit. And, of course, you and I were doing our work, and we're very serious. I don't want to praise both of us, but, you know, we're serious, right? We're trying to do a good job. Yeah. And we don't realize, right? We're naive, right? We're naive and don't realize that war is brewing, right? The war brew was starting to build up. Yeah. And actually, I did know it was brewing up because I wrote an article about the Middle East and Islam in 1998 called The Reluctant Crusaders, which I just want to say this introduces ideas. See, I actually predicted that Islam would attack the United States or attack the West. And it wasn't Islam per se. It was just some guys there, you know, some people who weren't happy. And it turned out to be Bin Laden types. But anyway, I predicted it, and everybody ignored me. Yeah, everybody. Totally ignored me. Right. They laughed at me. They laughed at me. So Jose, I think when you're in the job, your job, my job is to tell the truth, to establish goodwill, right, and manage things properly and correctly, and everybody responds. Everybody will respond. But the war thing starts to interfere, and before you know it, war breaks out, and then everything goes to hell. So anyway, that's my little speech.
Yeah,
you agree? Right. Yeah. So we were on track. You were on track to achieving great things, but the war interfered with it, obviously, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The only thing I can't argue with you is that we were sort of naive.
Yeah, no, naive. Well, we were. We were.
The question is that, you know, the way the U.S. behaved in relation to this question is totally crazy.
Yeah.
It was not for any reasonable people to realize that they would attack Iraq as a result of the things I was having. It made no sense.
Right.
It's not because we were naive, because it was totally uncalled for and totally
of course.
Illogical.
Yes.
But then again, it happens.
Hitler
was never logical in anything that he did.
Right. Well, I kind of figured in the late 90s that I could approach the Iraqi government, you know, Saddam Hussein's government, and I did, and it was working out just fine. I just want to tell you, you know, I didn't have the internet back then, and I was writing articles, you know, I was totally independent. I'm writing articles going around the world, and I reached out to them, and they responded, and I wrote a kind of a, you know, interesting monograph on Iraq. And then, you know, when the internet started up in 2002 for me, you know, I that's when I had the tool. I could be you know, a real publisher, and I approached the Iraqi government, and they were really interested. And I think you know, that was the problem. So you cannot have a dialogue when they want a war. It's not going to be easy to have a dialogue.
But then again, let me tell you to repeat our story. And that's how, at least there was in the corporate media, as we say today, some voices that could write, like you and others. Nowadays, my dear, there is no corporate voice that tells the truth.
Yeah, of course. I'm happy. Yeah, no, of course.
This is awful. This
it's
terrible.
Awful. Yeah, yeah.
We have to depend on some very daring, competent people who have their sites, etc.
Yeah.
And something that I don't manage very well because I'm too old for that.
Yeah.
My grandchildren do.
Okay.
But then again, going back to the okay, so that's a question. In my retirement here in Brazil, we had this problem with Syria, et cetera, and the allegation that Syria had used chemical weapons, and then the OPCW was invited to go on and inspect Syria and et cetera. So this happened. I was here in peace in my retirement. But some of the inspectors that were sent to were inspectors that started their career under my direction. So the senior inspectors, the most experienced inspectors of the CW, so they went there, they wrote their report, and their report said that that was fake. There was no chemical weapons used by Syria. That was, everything was made up.
Hmm.
They wrote that report, they submitted it to the Director General of the PCW then, and what did he do? He refused that report, and he asked some Americans to write another report.
Yeah.
Which said the opposite. And the inspectors were absolutely furious. And they called me and said, you have to help us because we are used to the way you work, et cetera, et cetera. So one of them came to Brazil and got me all the material for me to have a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you see, this is what we found.
Right.
And they refuse to publish it. They are publishing something that's not true.
Yeah.
And are you ready to help us? I said, of course I'm ready to. I'm ready to do anything in my power to tell the truth.
Yeah.
So we got in touch with some other people, an undersecretary, ex-undersecretary of the United Nations, von Sponik, and some members of the academic world and non-proliferation. So in the end, we had a group of 21 people.
Mm-hmm.
Today we call it the Berlin Group. And we helped these inspectors to try and impress the OPCW to accept that report, or at least to meet with them. The Director General refused to meet the inspectors, to meet with them, the own inspectors, and discuss the report. He never met them to this day.
Yeah.
Okay? So we took the question to the Security Council. And I was supposed to speak to the Security Council and tell the story of the inspectors, etc. I had it, fortunately, I had it recorded and filmed by the same guy who was doing the documentary. That's why I had the film for that. And knowing that in case I couldn't speak, the film would be shown.
Mm.
This is what happened.
Yeah.
In the session of the council, I was blocked by the UK, the US, and others to take the floor and speak on behalf of the inspectors. But then again, the president of the council then was the Russian ambassador. He read my speech. But anyway, it led to nowhere.
Yeah.
And again this year, this question came back because the inspectors are not giving up. And we are not giving up. And because it depends on establishing the truth for the OPCW to recover its...
The real mission,
Of its... It's a fake organization nowadays.
Yeah, it's fake. It's totally fake,
properly.
Yeah.
So you have to establish the truth and start afresh.
Right.
And I think that I have to do my job. I'm towards the end of my life. But I have to help them.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Because I still believe that the only way for the world to proceed is through multilateral organizations, not creations or a unipolar world or one country managing, manipulating the whole system of the world, etc.
Sure.
I don't believe in that.
No.
So I have to help them. And we are going to go on fighting
until
the world. But the problem was that the corporate press refused to publish anything that we wrote. Not a single newspaper in the US, in the UK, in France, in the Western world, not a single one.
Right.
Not even The Guardian, for example, used to be very supportive of me. Not even The Guardian.
It's amazing.
The Guardian, the Daily Telegraph and the Times is the same thing.
Right.
They are all alike.
Yeah, they're all alike. So Jose, why do you think this is the case? Why is it like this?
Well, I have many theories about that. I have some theories myself about this. I don't think that in the end, I think that's not the governments that are controlling the world. I think that there is something called the deep state. I believe that
deep state, yeah, of course.
No,
yeah.
Deep state, and of course the high tax and all the money that's behind us.
Yeah,
that can manipulate and the governments are themselves in fact hostage to this situation.
Yeah.
So within the government there are levels, and the U.S. government is an example of that. Historical, you know, the problem between the FBI, the CIA, the departments, the National Security Council, etc. And then the new world of the big techs and all the money that's behind them and the power that they have on the press.
Yeah.
And all the press moguls, etc. So it is difficult for anybody to fight against this. And
no
to
doubt,
identify
no doubt,
with
yeah.
As any country, what is it that is prevailing as a major political force to create the truth?
Mm-hmm.
To create a truth that's mm-hmm. not necessarily the truth.
Sure. Now, you and I are obviously devoted. Jose, you and I are obviously devoted to that ideal, the truth. We are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now, who in their right mind would not be seduced by this amazing power called truth? I mean, you know, you see what I'm saying? See what I'm asking? I mean, it's an amazing power, and you get seduced by it. I mean, when I was a kid, I said, hey, the truth is really cool, right? You too,
yeah,
probably.
It's really cool, but how can we tell public opinion that there is real truth, not the truth that is being sold to them by
yeah.
the media,
yeah.
the corporate media? Because, of course, those who are addicted to the internet world,
right.
Which I'm not. I'm very illiterate.
Okay.
Some of them do listen to other voices, but these voices are not published in newspapers.
No, they're not. Of course not. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very difficult. Some of them write me directly and ask for my opinion, etc. Fine, I'm happy with that. But then again, it's important.
Yeah.
To make sure and try to sensitize, you know, whoever we have to sensitize, that some of the corporate media at least should be ready to tell the truth.
Now,
I can't find them. Can't find them.
Yeah, you can't find them. Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, there's me. It's me. Now, now, don't you think it, you know, I'm going to get, really blunt here, but don't you think it's the creation of Israel, the state of Israel, that ultimately is the issue? Because, you know, these people, they're from Jewish Ashkenazi Jews from the Pale of Settlement, you know, back in, you know, started coming to the United States in 1880, a couple of million of them. And they're in the United States now, you know, and their descendants are, you know, in important positions. They're kind of running the government, and they want Israel to be top dog in the Middle East. It's that simple, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it's that simple. Actually.
No? Okay.
I prefer not to refer in particular to the question of Israel, because the thing is, of course, I'm not
because
defending Israel.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Israel
but
making huge mistakes, has always made huge mistakes, in particular now.
Right.
If they go on with what Mr. Netanyahu is pretending to do.
Yeah.
It's going to be a disaster.
Yeah,
but
of course,
then again, I think
yeah.
the situation is already out of any control. The Palestinian state will, from my point of view, will never be established.
No, no.
Unless the rest of the world, supports the decision by the Council 50 years ago, which was for the creation of the state of Israel.
Right.
So nobody does that, except some countries like Brazil and others in the third world. So it's never going to happen.
Right.
So there are situations, for example, Israel has occupied the Golan Heights. Who talks about that?
No, nobody.
It's
yeah.
Syrian territory. Nobody criticized that.
Mm-hmm.
But then they criticize when Russia takes Donbass.
Right, right. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Why
so
don't
we
they criticize that? it's amazing.
Yeah.
So I can't stand to this. I'm not defending Russia, but I think double standards are
of course.
Part of my culture. I'm not part of my you know, my mind. I can't deal with that.
Right.
Without being, you know, outraged.
I am too. Like I said, when I was a kid, I remember thinking, okay, Tom, the truth is very powerful, and you're going to work for example, I'll just brag and tell you that in 2016, I'm a neuroscientist, by the way, and in 2016, I redefined what epilepsy is. And one of the top neurologists in the United States, epilepsy specialist at Stanford, Robert Fisher, I got him on the phone, and he was stunned that he said, "You're probably right." You know, and it's now 2023, and no one has discussed this. You see, so it's not just in international politics, and not in chemical weapons. It's, you know, not you and I are diplomats, but I mean, it's everywhere in the world. It's just called power.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes,
and
this is what's really terrible.
I mean, 7 years, 7 years, and it's amazing. I'm not going to brag, but I mean, it's probably a big event in the history of medical science. You know, it's a big event if I'm right, and chances are I am right, and everybody kind of knows I'm right, and no one will discuss it.
Absolutely. And, you know, in Brazil, we are at the advantage because at least in the U.S. and maybe in the U.K., so there are people like you who have a voice, who have an access to public opinion through the channels that you use. But here in Brazil, we don't have any... A new person in Brazil is totally ignorant. They are not specialized. They don't know.
Yeah.
They just copy what they read from
the
international media. From Anglo-Saxon media. But
I see. Yeah. Okay.
So it's a repetition of what you read. I don't know how to deal with them.
Right.
Because our media doesn't ask me to give my opinion about what is written by them.
Yeah.
They don't want to.
Okay.
Because they all, you know.
Okay.
They all follow what.
Right.
The,
they follow.
The
yes,
say.
Of course.
The masters come from the north.
Right.
You know.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So Brazil, Jose, Brazil is pretty much captive of the Western countries. I mean,
it was totally captured by Western countries until last year.
Okay.
Fortunately, New York is back in power.
Okay.
And I believe that they are furious, of course. The press, again, is trying to, you know, to destroy all the attempts Lula is doing to bring the country back to you know, to what it was before. It's a huge, huge, an uphill battle. For Lula, you know, at this particular moment. But I believe that he will succeed. He's a very competent group of people. I think that his cabinet is very competent, people that understand what they are doing, etc. Except that we have to fight, you know, public opinion. The public opinion is following what the press says, and the press is the Western press.
All right, right,
commanding the major papers in São Paulo and in Rio. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's what it is. And it's very difficult, you know. I'm volunteering to take the floor and go to TV, etc., to try and explain to people that there is another truth, and they have to be clever, and they have to understand that there is another truth that's not the one that's published normally.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, do you think it's possible, Jose, that the world is going to come together at some point and realize that you and I are right, you know, that we got to do the job properly, correctly, and the truth, we have to work on the, you know, getting the truth and working, you know, being beholden to the truth. Do you think it's possible?
I hope it is.
Yeah.
As I said, I am an idealistic person. And I hope I'm still alive when it happens.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure.
Okay. Yeah.
But then again, I hope, yes, I hope so. And I believe that the present situation, this question with Russia and Ukraine, may be a starting point.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Depending on how the world reacts to some attempts being launched by my president, together with China and India and others, to try and stop the war, sit down, and try and negotiate
a resolution. Yeah, yeah.
Now, and I think from that moment, if that happens, if the Americans do not manipulate and use the Europeans the way they are doing, the Europeans are paying the price.
Yeah, of course. This war. Yes.
America is not suffering anything. On the contrary,
right.
It's selling weapons and their oil to the Europeans, etc. It's a huge business for the United States.
Yes, of course.
War.
Yes.
Don't forget that.
What would you say? What would you say, Jose, about the origins of this war in Ukraine? Now, I was opposed to the enlargement of NATO in the 90s. You know, I was opposed to that. But, you know, I couldn't stop it, right? I couldn't. What am I going to do? How am I going to stop it? Right. So.
From my point of view, when I lived in Moscow, I was my first posting. So I speak Russian. I lived there.
Oh, wow.
I know the way Russians speak. I understand their culture.
Yeah.
So. When Gorbachev entered into an understanding with the West and Reagan, etc., maybe it was a little bit too early, but it happened, so
yeah.
I understand. But I trusted that what was decided then would be, respected by both parties.
Right.
So the Warsaw Pact would disappear, and NATO would disappear as well, because there would be no meaning for NATO to go on.
Yeah.
But it never happened.
Right.
Okay. The Russians went on. Unfortunately, under Yeltsin, they lost total control of everything. And it was really a dark period for Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Until someone came with Mr. Putin. In the beginning, he was really, he helped Russia.
Yes, very much, yes.
Completely out of control.
Yeah.
Fine. But then again, in the beginning, he was extremely cooperative towards the West.
Of course, yes.
He made proposals, there were negotiations, the agreements in Minsk, etc. He even proposed Russia to become a member of the European Union, which was not accepted by the Europeans on suggestion of the United States. So can you imagine if the European Union had accepted Russia as a member of the European Union, what the situation would be today for the world.
Mm-hmm.
It would be totally different. It would be a natural development of the history of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Russia is
mm-hmm.
an European country. It's an Indo-European country. But more half of Russia is European, historically. They always followed the French culture and German culture and everything.
Yeah.
So they feel that they are European. Most of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, Russia proper is European. Soviet Union was European and Asian, but Russia is European.
Yeah.
It's a pity that this happened.
Yeah, but it is. It really is.
I think that 2015 was the turning point.
Yeah.
When they interfered in the government of Kiev, and when we saw the lady, the American lady, what's her name again?
Yeah, Victoria Nuland. You're talking
exactly.
Newland, okay.
He's selling pretty food, bread in the streets of Kiev, campaigning for Mr. Zelensky. That was a disaster. This is completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, you have to understand, Russia has always been an empire. They have a different way of looking at the world.
Yeah.
The history is different. It's an old country. And there was a point where they could not tolerate the fact that it was being humiliated the way they were.
Yeah, sure.
After all, they are nuclear power.
Right.
They had joined the Western in terms of economy, etc. They are a capitalistic country, etc. So what else? That mentality coming from the West, in particular the West in the UK, that Russia has to be destroyed and submitted. This is a disaster. And now they are creating a new enemy, who is China. And mixing things up. It's going to be even worse.
Yeah.
But I tell you, I believe that there is a movement that is creating momentum among major countries within the third world, like India, Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, and other countries in Africa.
Okay,
to say, well, let's give it a pause.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a unipolar world. And of course, China has a really important role to play because it's a major economy. So I think it may change things. The moment this group of of people, of countries, get together, be it through the BRICS organization, through any other type of arrangement. If you put together China, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, most of Latin America, and Africa, etc., and create a forum for discussions of peace in the world at the present moment. Mm-hmm. It might work.
Now, they don't really have that much clout, but they're doing well. They're doing well.
You have to stop.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree.
And I feel that there are some, changes, even within Europe. I think that Macron's, talks to the Chinese recently were interesting.
Of course. I think, Macron is recognizing that I'm correct, that we do have a polar world, whatever you want to call it, where power is balanced around the world, somewhat balanced. And it's coming, but people are irritated by that because obviously they don't like change. Here in America, there's a lot of folks in Washington, for example, that are outraged that China is doing so well.
Yeah, of course, they don't want anybody to be different.
They don't.
Well, it's amazing that they don't learn the lesson.
Yeah, no, they don't. Yeah.
For me, it's amazing that the Europeans that have gone through two world wars and suffered so much, they don't realize what is at stake for them, the way they are behaving in relation to this particular question, which touched them very closely. They should be the voices of reason.
But here's my question for you, Jose. Here's my question.
To the Russians.
Yeah, you speak Russian. You're an experienced diplomat. Excellent career. Why is it so difficult for the world we're talking about the history of the world. Why is it so difficult to move from one era to another? You have, the Westphalia and you have, French Revolution. You have a lot of upheavals and it's always some kind of traumatic event that ushers in the new system. Napoleon, for example, brought in the new France and, he was just going around Europe undertaking war. So I don't know. It seems like very difficult for us to move beyond the Cold War, World War II world into the new world. It seems like it's going to be difficult. What would be your comment?
Yeah.
You agree?
I agree in part, yes. But then again, you don't necessarily have to think that it must be a war
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's...
You have the Cuba crisis, which was very serious, but it was not war.
Yeah.
So we managed to go through that period. So I understand that the Ukrainian question, for example, may be another Cuban thing.
Yeah.
And then again, after that, some type of agreement will be reached. And there are many ways of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You can choose the Korean example as a solution. You can choose the Cyprus example, for example. You don't have to have a treaty, etc. You have to freeze what's the aggression that's taking place now, and create a situation that will lead us again until the civilization of each country is mature enough to come to an agreement and, as it happened in Vietnam, for example. It happened.
Yeah.
I believe that, time will say, but I believe that the two Koreas will come to an agreement eventually.
I agree. I've been promoting it.
And I believe that Russia and Ukraine can also come.
I totally agree.
But the Western world does not want to understand what is going on there. They don't want to understand that Ukraine belongs to that Crimea belongs to Ukraine because Crimea was Russian and Crimea was Soviet Union was the Ukraine or Soviet Union. Gorbachev decided just to please then. The head of the Department of Ukraine, because he never imagined that the Soviet Union would disappear. Mm-hmm. So that was a part of the history of Russia, and important, and strategically speaking, it's fundamental mm-hmm. for the survival of the Russian country, mm-hmm. in fact. We never in Russia never discussed Ukraine or Russia as different people.
No, of course not.
You know, married each other, and it was like a state of the Soviet Union.
Sure.
You'd go to Kiev, you took a train, you want to go to Kiev, and you go to Miami from Washington. You see, this mentality was really created and stimulated by the West, this hate of by some Ukrainians, it's not to Russia. Mm-hmm. That was the seduction of the capitalist consumer society mm-hmm. in many ways.
Yeah.
This is what happened. I agree.
Now, I agree with you that North and South Korea are going to reunite. I agree. And I think the Slavs will unite, and the war in Ukraine will come to an end. I think this will all happen. I can't explain exactly why, but I think it's just destiny. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm. I don't think any of these countries are ready to use any nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
To be honest, I don't believe that.
No,
because it's unusable.
Yeah.
Unusable.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
Even today, using chemical weapons would be a disaster. Iraq used it in small quantities, and you see what happened.
Yeah.
Right. So you can't control. You can't put a curtain and say, no, the weapon will not move to the Amman neighbor. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So a nuclear weapon explosion is uncontrollable.
Yeah.
And why would they launch a nuclear weapon in Ukraine and knowing that they will be affected immediately as a leader? So I don't think this is going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't think. I think that good sense will prevail. But then again, politicians are short-sighted in many ways.
Yeah.
No, to be honest, I have a point. I have a sensation that if Mrs. Merkel were the Chancellor of Germany, this would not have happened.
Probably not, no.
This would not have happened.
Yeah.
Probably not, because she was brought up within the Soviet system.
Of course,
she understood how that they feel the world.
Yeah.
She would have, although being a conservative, she was a woman of vision. She was a very good politician.
Oh, yeah, very good.
Not Mr. Scholz.
Yeah.
Mr. Scholz is, he doesn't have the spine for that.
Right.
And unfortunately, then again.
Well,
let's hope for the best.
We're going on about 50 minutes. I thought, we could talk again in a week or two, if you want, and kind of recapitulate some of these things. Yeah, that would be good. Now, I agree. I mean, I don't want to cut you off, but, 50 minutes, I usually like to keep it to an hour. So I'm just going to recapitulate here. So you were trying to do your job as head of the OPCW in a fair-minded way, and you were bringing on board all sorts of countries around the world who agreed with this principle of fair-mindedness, right? And of course, but Washington wanted war. They probably, were determined, okay, we're going to have war, and that's just the way it goes. And so, I was opposed to that. You were opposed to that. Well, that's the way it happens.
Washington never expected that I would not follow their instructions.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe I am the first elected general of organization that just followed my own conscience. Mm-hmm. I refused to follow what they tried to dictate things from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And refused. And that shocked them.
Yeah, it shocked them, yeah.
and at the same time, I was pivotal then. As far as Iraq was in question for the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what happened.
Yeah.
That's what happened. But then again, at least I taught them a lesson. Because that as I was ousted, I went to the International Labor Organization and I sued the Americans. And the decision was that it's illegal to oust the director general the way I was ousted.
Yeah.
So He will not fight that.
Very good. Congratulations. Yeah, no, that's good. I read that. I read that, and I was very impressed. And I'll tell you what. I think I'll email you, and we can talk again in a couple of weeks, and we can talk about international politics, and it's a lot of fun, and I appreciate it. I think your voice is coming in okay clear. It's clear enough, so I'm hoping that. But anyway, I hope you're well, and say hello to your family, and okay, thanks so much, Jose. Bye-bye.
Enjoy California.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.